Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, we're proud to present a conversation about the slippery slope of censorship and what you can do to preserve your community's freedom to read. The following conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Millennium Park Partner Stage at the American Writers Festival. I'm Linda Dunleavy, Director of Development at the American Writers Museum, and I'm delighted to introduce the next program of the day, sponsored by the American Library Association, a planning partner of this festival. As book bans are enacted by right-wing state governments and school boards across the country, citing everything from racial bias to LGBTQ content, children's book authors and those who care about the freedom to read are fighting back. We're here today to listen to young adult and children's book author Jarrett DePierre in conversation with Deborah Caldwell Stone, director of the ALA Office for Intellectual Freedom, and Kristen Picol, assistant director of the ALA Office for Intellectual Freedom, about what you can do to protect your community's freedom to read. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome, everyone. My name is Kristen Picol and I work with the American Library Association. We are the oldest and largest library association in the world. Our mission is to provide leadership for the development, promotion, and improvement of library and information services. As part of the ALA, the Office for Intellectual Freedom implements ALA's policies concerning the concept of intellectual freedom as embodied in the Library Bill of Rights, the association's basic policy on free access to libraries and library materials. The goal of the office is to educate librarians and the general public about the nature and importance of intellectual freedom and the harms of censorship. Today we're talking with OIF's director, Deborah Caldwell Stone, in conversation with our special guest, Jarrett DePierre. Jarrett is a librarian with over 12 years of experience working with teens in Chicagoland libraries. In 2016, he was awarded the John Philip Imroth Memorial Award for the ALA Intellectual Freedom Roundtable for his research in the 2013 effort by the Chicago Public Schools to ban the graphic novel Persepolis. Jarrett was named a 2019 Library Journal Mover and Shaker for his work producing social justice-oriented teen theater at the Skokie Public Library in partnership with the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. Also an author for children and teens, Jarrett's most recent picture books are Mr. Watson's Chickens, published by Chronicle Books, and Jazz for Lunch, published by Simon & Schuster. His graphic novel, Wake Now in the Fire, illustrated by A.J. Dungo, is based on his Persepolis censorship research and will be published by Chronicle Books in 2023. Jarrett's a newly elected member of the Freedom to Read Foundation's Board of Trustees. Deborah Caldwell Stone is the director of ALA's Office for Intellectual Freedom and the executive director of the Freedom to Read Foundation. For nearly two decades, she has helped libraries, librarians and trustees address a wide range of intellectual freedom issues, including the censorship of books and other library resources, library policies, and the privacy of library users' records. She also advises ALA member groups on law and policy concerns and has done presentations for lawyers, trustees, and librarians addressing First Amendment and privacy law. She is a former appellate litigator. So, Deborah, my first question is for you. You not only work with librarians in individual cases, but you have a broader national perspective. Can you share the top-level view with us?
Absolutely, Kristen. In 2021, we saw an unprecedented and remarkable increase in the number of demands to remove books from the shelves of schools and libraries across the country. In 2021, we had 729 documented demands to remove books, representing some 1,597 titles. Understand that when there's a demand to remove books, Often there are multiple titles included in that demand. And just for some comparison to understand what those numbers mean, in 2019, which was the last year before the pandemic when all schools and libraries were open, we received 377 reports affecting 566 books. In 2020, during the pandemic, we only received 156 reports. But that number has now more than tripled for 2021. And what we're seeing is a number of well-organized, well-funded partisan advocacy groups who are targeting our school boards and our library boards, campaigning to censor books and other resources. The targets of these censors are remarkably narrow. They are targeting books that describe the lives of gay, queer, and transgender youth and describe the experiences of LGBTQ persons. They're also targeting books by Black authors, books that reflect the lives and experiences of Black, Indigenous, and persons of color, and also books that explore American history from an African-American perspective. These groups have had remarkable success in exploiting the divisions and fears that are in our society today. They're raising moral panics that spur library boards and school boards to actually ignore written policy, ignore written law, to arbitrarily remove dozens, if not hundreds, of books. We've seen photographs of school boards literally boxing up hundreds of books at one time, simply because these groups claim that they're pornographic or claim that they represent some false idea of what's called critical race theory, but actually represent an attempt to silence the voices of Black authors and Black historians. And the worst thing that we've seen this year is a number of groups have actually gone so far as to file criminal charges against librarians and teachers for simply doing their jobs of providing books and information to students, claiming that by providing books that deal with LGBTQ experience and concerns, or deal with comprehensive sex ed, or are simply young adult novels that offer a realistic perspective on controversial issues like drug abuse, suicide, or first love, how controversial is that, that they're pandering obscenity to minors. And so we've seen a number of incidents where prosecutors actually have investigated librarians for simply having books on the shelf. And what's worse, they've actually convinced elected officials to introduce laws, to pass legislation that target books because they are dealing with racism, sexism, or that they're, you know, these don't say gay bills that are silencing the voices of teachers in K through 12 schools, that they can't simply even talk about the fact that even when there's families in their school that are headed by same-sex couples, they can't talk about it. So, you know, they're also running for school boards. These pro-censorship groups are putting up candidates. And they're here in Illinois as well. They're putting up candidates for school boards and library boards. They may not talk about it during the election, but when they're seated, they have a pro-censorship agenda that's targeting these books that they want out, whether they're targeted for pornography or critical race theory or other reasons. And so that's what we're seeing right now in the United States.
How has this been different from the fight for freedom to read that we've seen in the past?
Well, we've always had censorship, you know, and frankly, you know, particularly censorship targeting books intended for young people. And we can look back, 1990s, there is the moral panic over secular humanism. In the early 2000s, Harry Potter was the target of the censors. You know, he was teaching kids to defy adult authority, so they said. And we've always had challenges to books dealing with coming of age. You know, think of John Green novels, Judy Blume novels. And, you know, it's always been there, these challenges, but it's really ramped up. Now it's organized, now it's targeted. We're seeing these groups like Moms for Liberty, No Left Turn in Education, plant local chapters and communities who then target the school boards for their complaints. And they've been really successful. You know, this was not really anticipated, and so they've been the loudest voice in the room, and they've succeeded in getting all these books either challenged or removed. You know, it doesn't always happen, but, you know, sometimes the school boards push back. They keep the books on the shelf. Sometimes they have to be encouraged. We saw that in Wentzville, Missouri. They banned The Bluest Eye from the book, from the library. The ACLU filed a lawsuit under the First Amendment to vindicate the students' First Amendment rights, and all of a sudden they voted Bluest Eye back on the shelves of the library. But you know, these partisan campaigns is just what's so frightening right now. They're endorsing the idea that censorship is a tool for lack of education, for indoctrination. And it's a very real attack on our democracy and our democratic values. You know, and traditionally librarians have always championed and defended the freedom to speak, the freedom to publish, and the freedom to read. We support the First Amendment of the United States. We support the broader idea of intellectual freedom and the freedom to select a variety of books and materials that provide access to a variety of ideas and beliefs is a necessary safeguard for our democracy. And we want to fight and defend the individual person's individual liberty to form their own ideas and opinions through free and open inquiry. And we can only do that by fighting the censorship.
Thank you. Jared, can you tell us a little bit about your experience with censorship?
Sure. Before I do, I just want to take a moment to acknowledge the murders that occurred yesterday in Buffalo. And I want us to think about and grieve the people who lost their lives, but also I want us to think deeply about the fact that that other murders of BIPOC folks and other acts of horrifying violence against them are the inevitable, arguably intentional result of book banning attempts. Because book banning attempts are, by definition, dehumanization acts. They're aggressive, they're acts of erasure, erasing people from the national conversation, erasing people and their experiences, saying that they don't exist or they don't count. And the banning of books really, because they dramatize and provide information and represent BIPOC children and adults, it's always an act of dehumanization. And this strangles the heart and its capacity to love. And it encourages and leads to violence like what we saw yesterday. The killer yesterday stated openly that it was his intention to kill people of color. And he drove to a place that he thought he could achieve that goal. It's horrifying and really upsetting. I also want to acknowledge each of you, especially each of you here who might be struggling with depression, pain, and grief right now. There's just been so much in terms of painful incidents and violence against children and people of color, as well as LGBTQ folks. When we're consuming and absorbing this news, mm-hmm. or hearing about these actions, you know, it doesn't roll off of all of us. I'm sure it doesn't roll off of any of us. And these stories and what they represent and what they implicate, they land blows over and over on our hearts. And so anybody who's feeling depression and grief, it's natural and it's normal given what's going on, especially because of the fact that so much of this has to do with children and people attacking the rights of children to read and simply to be. And I certainly can't let those things just roll off of me. So I hope that those of you who also are feeling really heavy or have support and are getting help. Fighting it is really hard, so thank you to all of you for being here. In terms of my own experience, so I wrote this book called Mr. Watson's Chickens, and it's about two men who are a same-sex couple. They're in love, and they are grappling with an overwhelming chicken problem. Mr. Watson and Mr. Nelson have they've adopted three chickens, but over a short period of time, that chicken collection grows to 456 chickens, and they've all moved in. And at first, it's fun. It's the illustrator, Andrea Cerumi, who identifies as queer, they did an absolutely outstanding job depicting chickens doing as many things as anyone could imagine chickens doing. Flying kites, skateboarding, putting on plays, there's bowling, I think there's pillow fights. They really drew an incredibly hilarious book. So at first, this experience is fine for the two guys, until it's not. And Mr. Nelson pleads with his partner, Mr. Watson, can we please do something about these chickens? And his pleas get more and more desperate until Mr. Watson realizes that Mr. Nelson is feeling that it's either the chickens or him. And so they go to the fair to find a loving new home for the chickens. And while there, the chickens escape. And the two men, as well as people at the fair, all sort of band together to try and find the chickens. Has a happy ending and a surprise little twist at the end. Mr. Watson's Chickens is intended to make children laugh, first and foremost. And also, it's intended to tell a story about two people who, despite the fact that they are same-sex, have a reaction to 456 chickens in their house that anyone would, which is panic and a sense of helplessness and a sense that we really need to take care of this problem. However, as you can imagine, there are, especially in this climate, there are quite a few people who don't agree that that's what the book is about and why it was intended. My experiences with censorship events started last fall when I was trying to find schools that I could where I could read the book. As an author for kids, one of the things I dreamed about most was being able to visit them and read aloud to them. Reading aloud to kids, especially my own kids, is just one of the joys of my life. And so, you know, I have quite a few family members in the area, people whose whose kids go to area schools. So I thought, you know, through that network, I'll approach the librarians and see if anyone's interested in me either virtually reading or attending in person. And right away, I ran up against concerns about the same-sex couple. Specifically, and these are, and you can talk about this, these are connected directly to anti-mask fervor. Mm-hmm. So a school in Glen Ellen had just had in September an incredibly chaotic and aggressive anti-mask presence at a school board meeting. This was so volatile that it made national news. It was covered probably by Fox. And I approached the school after this event, and the teacher specifically that I was talking to, I said I'd like to read Mr. Watson's Chickens, and she said, please do not read Mr. Watson's Chickens. And I asked why, and she said, I cannot put up with any more attacks. And she knew that if I were invited to read to these second graders, it was going to get back to the parents, who were the same parents that were threatening people on the school board, threatening administrators, and so on. And so she just asked, please don't do it. And it ended up not working out that I didn't end up reading anything because of the pandemic and just schedules. But then very quickly after that, I had approached a school in Wheaton. Wheaton has got a very large evangelical Christian community and is known for that, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, of course it's known for it. When I took my daughter trick-or-treating there when she was 3, somebody gave her one of those little comics that said she was going to hell unless she accepted Jesus into her heart. And she didn't even get any candy. It's like, at least pin a Snickers to it. But in a sense, I knew what I was getting into in Wheaton. However, this was my nephew's school. So I thought, hey, you know, my nephew goes there. This would be so cool. And I know he would love it. This school's librarian said, I would love to have you in. And I think she was, I don't know if she's just acting, giving people the benefit of the doubt, or she was truly naive, but she moved forward as though this is going to happen. And she said, okay, so what needs to happen now is I'm going to give Mr. Watson's Chickens to our principal. If he approves it, then the next step is it goes to the front office, And the parent community is alerted that we want to have an author in, and everyone is free and welcome to come and review the book before we book the author. So they have this parental review policy. And I privately thought, well, there's no freaking way I'm reading it in Wheaton. But I didn't even get to the front office. She wrote me about a week later and just said, it's not going to work out, so thanks so much. And that was it. It was over. And it was clear that the principal had said no way. So those were my first two sort of forays into the experience of having books, or I guess they were appearances, censored or suppressed. But
I'm going to interrupt you for a second, because I do want to point out that though we talk about books being challenged and banned on a national level, we also consider things like author visits, programs, displays, any resource and service that a library provides when it is canceled or banned because of challenge to the content, whether the author was gay, whether the characters are gay, whether there's a, you know, whatever might be in it. That is also considered censorship and something that our office actively tracks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you that you weren't the first author canceled for that reason in,
sure.
in Glen Ellyn. In 2019, Robin Stevenson was supposed to present to the fourth and fifth graders at Longview, mm-hmm. Longfellow Elementary in Glen Ellyn. And simply because the book didn't address this topic at all, just illustrated kids of color and a same-sex couple, her whole appearance was abruptly canceled. Now, in that case, a local bookstore pushed back, and they rented the auditorium at Glenbard West, and they invited Robin to come in and do the reading she would have done otherwise. But this is a long history in these suburbs.
Yeah. Those first two events for me were very brief. Mm-hmm. You know, when the event would have occurred was months before they said no thanks. Mm-hmm. After the new year, however, I was booked at a elementary school in Lake Bluff, and the librarian and I had it booked and confirmed as early as October. I was supposed to read in January, and we exchanged 50 emails back and forth about how this was going to go down. They paid me well in advance. I know that the librarian invited teachers to have their classes attend in December, so everything was in the works. And the night before the reading, I got a one-sentence email that said, "Jarrett, your appearance tomorrow is canceled. Thank you very much for your time." And I was completely bowled over, and I emailed back, "What's going on? Why did this happen?" I got another one sentence that said, "I'm going to let the principal talk to you about that." And the principal didn't contact me, so I ended up having to reach out to the principal, trying to get her on the phone. I was sort of desperately asking for an explanation and also pleading with them to treat me professionally, which took a lot of work on my part. And eventually, I finally got the principal on the line and discovered that I was supposed to read on a Thursday. On Tuesday, they had an incredibly volatile anti-mask situation at the school board meeting. The police were called to it. The entire staff were feeling very vulnerable, very fragile, and the principal did not admit, she would not admit, although we spoke for over an hour on the phone, that the event was canceled because there's a same-sex couple in the book. She said, the librarian never read the book, and she came to me on Wednesday and said, I have to admit, I never read it. And we just have a policy that if we book an author, the librarian has to read the book before the author shows up. So that's why we're canceling, because it just didn't meet procedure. I was very skeptical, and so I kept pushing and I kept pushing. And I said, well, so why didn't you sit down and just read it right there? And it's less than 1,000 words. She could have read it to you. But she just wouldn't go there, and it was very clear this was a homophobic event that occurred, that she kept referencing how the staff were feeling and how insecure, how unsafe they were feeling, and was implying that if I were to read, there's a high likelihood that the staff and the administrators would be, the faculty and administrators would be attacked, and they cannot handle this right now. She never came as far as to say, I made a mistake, I just made a judgment call on behalf of my staff, but she implied it over and over that she was doing this, but she also said over and over, we don't censor, and we never would, and this is not what, that is not what's happening here. But I couldn't get clear answers, and luckily I had a couple parents that I knew who were very upset and also called the principal, and I was in touch with them. One of them was a member of the newly formed inclusivity committee at the school, who asked the principal, what the hell is going on? And that person told me that the principal said, we can't just present a book about a same-sex couple without preparing the students for this first. And she argued back, what do they need to be prepared for? And I said to the principal basically the same thing. If anything, if you're arguing that the students need to be prepared or the book needs to be contextualized, your teachers should be teaching about incubating eggs and how to raise chicks, which would be very educational. But there's nothing about their relationship that needs to be talked about or taught about whatsoever. And so when I said to her, is this what's going on? She said, no, absolutely not. I do not need to prepare the teachers for this at all. But then when I asked, all right, so, because she said she'd like to reschedule. All of this was, a week's worth of work after my wife at home had fractured her ankle and was laid up in bed after surgery. And this was just very disruptive and emotionally upsetting. And she said she'd like to reschedule, and I said, I would be interested in that, but I need to know that you're not going to do anything where you mandate that the teachers have to prepare the kids for seeing two men in love. And she said, no, we're not going to do that at all. And then I said, will you also promise that you are not going to send out any messages to parents saying that this is the content of this book, and you have the right to opt out your child from attending that day? And she really hedged on that and said, I'm going to have further conversations with staff about that one. And I said, well, I'm not going to appear if that happens, so just let me know what your decision is. Andrea, the illustrator, also helped. They wrote a really powerful Twitter thread that laid out why this is a homophobic event, why it's dehumanizing, which got a lot of traction, and I know the principal saw that, so that was added pressure that she was feeling. And eventually, it was the National Coalition Against Censorship ended up saying, it was the head there said, you might as well present if they'll let you, because otherwise the kids don't get to hear the book. And it seems like a really simple thought that is just, just logical. But I hadn't thought of the fact that if I say, screw this, I'm out, the kids don't get to hear Mr. Watson's chickens. And I kept wondering, what were the kids told about why I wasn't there? Because they all thought as late as Wednesday that there was an author event on Thursday morning. So I still to this day don't know what they were told, but I just imagine it was very confusing. And so I did really want to make it happen. Long story, long. I read to the kids. The principal did promise they were doing no opt-out letter. There would be nothing like that. And that was that. So I got to read, and it was a really fun reading, and I had a blast. And the kids seemed to as well.
It sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this wasn't your first attempt first interaction with censorship. You were kind of prepared with how school districts hedge around removing books before in 2013.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that one.
So I don't know how many folks know this, but in 2013, the Chicago Public Schools acted to ban the graphic novel Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi. And the mandate there was that all copies of Persepolis be removed from every single school in the city run by CPS. And it was a blanket order. And the whole you know, the entire structure of CPS can be very confusing, mm-hmm. but they have this office called the Office of Network Supports. And within that office, there are district chiefs, and those chiefs oversee a number of different schools in an area. And when this directive was given out by the head of that office, to go to the schools physically and gather up all copies of Persepolis that you find and remove them. Luckily, only one district chief acted on it. Mm-hmm. There was some evidence that another one tried, but the school just didn't even have Persepolis.
And you have to know that at the time, CPS had written policy on the books in their divisions of libraries that said that you could not remove a book from the shelf on basis of a complaint, whether it was inside the system or outside the system, that there had to be a reconsideration committee put together, and the book only removed after the action of the reconsideration committee. So the other part of that is that all of a sudden they had to rewrite the order to leave the books in the libraries, otherwise they would be in violation of their own written policy.
Which was great, and it was thanks to the librarian at Lane Tech, so it was Lane Tech High School that this network chief went to and, you know, said, I have to take these books. And for some reason, the chair of the English department said, right away, and went to the teacher who teaches Persepolis, interrupted her at lunch, and said, you need to get up right now and go to your classroom and get these books for me. It was, you know, they were treating it as if this was an emergency. Mm-hmm. And so it was something like 22 copies were removed from that from that classroom and then taken to the office. For some reason, they didn't, that network chief, like, left before taking the books. So the books stayed there, but they were, like, locked up. And they never grabbed the two or three copies that were in the library. So word spread really fast amongst teachers, but also students, because the teacher whose books were removed talked to her topics in literature class that afternoon. And the students were really upset. They had read Persepolis and loved it. And a couple of them, whom I interviewed while I was in grad school about this incident, said that it was seeing their teachers' sense of feeling violated and their own sense of feeling violated that made them vow right away to do something about it, to try and make this a bigger issue media-wise and just bring people's attention and thought to it. And so while the students were organizing after this event occurred, the librarian at Lane Tech then
reached out
to you and then also to the Department of Libraries within CPS.
Right.
They said, we haven't heard about this. And then they said they took care of contacting, you know.
Getting the directive rewritten.
Right.
But what really kind of launched this is apparently the principal at Lane Tech accidentally hit reply all to an email detailing what was going on with Persepolis. Mm-hmm. And it went out to the entire system. And that was what, and I got multiple copies of that forwarded to the office from different places all over. And so we reached out at that point to the Lane Tech librarian. Just a simple little computer mistake, and the entire world knew about the attempt to censor Persepolis.
Right. And there's a lot of really fun side stories in this story where because the copies weren't actually taken away, the head of the Department of English had said, so bring these copies to the office, and then they're going to be transported to the Department of Literacy. And the teacher was, you know, rightfully curious, what's going to happen then? Or do they go in a wood chipper or what? But they didn't know. But because it was never picked up and taken away, as soon as the Department of Libraries made it clear you can't just remove library copies, that teacher brought the copies that were in the office to the library at Lane Tech, and the librarian then cataloged them all on the spot as library copies. And this also occurred at Northside College Prep. And the backstory is that those 22 copies of the book were given as a gift from the previous Lane Tech teacher who taught that class to the one at that time who was teaching the class when she left. So, and they were her personal copies. This teacher, her name's Nora Flanagan, she's a good friend of mine, and she had been chosen as a fantastic teacher by Oprah in like 1999, taken on the show and given, it was an award from Disney as like great teacher. and she used the money to buy this big set of Persepolis copies. And when she left, she said, well, I got it for my teaching here at Lane Tech, so it should stay here. She gave it to Miss Mason, and then Miss Mason was the one who was able to say to the principal who sent that reply all, and who has since been indicted on criminal charges in another school district, she said, you can't take them because they're not actually classroom copies. They're my personal copies because Nora gave them to me. And he was sort of like, didn't know what to do, so he left them, and then the librarian took care of it. But when Nora heard about this, she was at Northside College Prep, and they had a big bunch of Persepolis copies taught in a social studies class. She goes to the storeroom as soon as she hears this, and she takes them all, and then she locks them in the trunk of her car. I asked her when I interviewed her for my paper, weren't you sort of then suppressing the book? She said, this was an emergency motion on my part to protect the book from the hands of CPS. And then when that library thing happened, she did the same thing, where she took them, went to the librarian, and they were cataloged and filed as library copies. You can imagine that student interest in Persepolis skyrocketed. I worked at Evanston Public Library at the time, and I was following all of this as it unfolded on Twitter because, again, the students were great at getting the word out via social media. So I took our Persepolis copies, put them out on display. They were checked out within a day. I spoke with folks at Harold Washington. They said people were interested in Persepolis right away. Just kids were reading it all over. And the librarian at Northside College Prep said at one point there was a line out the library of kids waiting to get a copy of Persepolis. So it had the opposite effect, as it often can. But CPS would never admit that it was, they would never explain why this even happened. Mm-hmm. When asked, what are you doing? They would say over and over, this was a error in communication. We never intended to ban the book. We would never ban books. We're against censorship. But when pressed, how did this happen? They were just sort of mum. And I think you could talk about what happened.
Well, what we did at the Freedom to Read Foundation is a First Amendment defense arm of the American Library Association. And so the Freedom to Read Foundation filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and we had already talked to the ACLU of Illinois, who filed their own request. And we were both shut down. We were told there were no documents responsive to our request. And I promise you, my request was very detailed, with knowledge of library policy and procedure in CPS. I've had many years of experience with that. And to be told that there were no emails, and frankly, at the time, we didn't have resources to really litigate that in courts, and we looked at it with the ACLU, and we let it go. And then Jarrett came along.
So keep in mind, they said, there's nothing, there's no emails, we have nothing to produce. Mm-hmm. And that was their official line. So I wrote a thesis paper on this event because I had always been curious what happened, and I wanted to create a timeline and get the voices of the students who were there that fought back. I wanted to interview them, teachers, staff, and everybody, and just sort of write a definitive, short sort of story about what happened. But I could not find information about why it happened and who was involved. And so just doing my due diligence, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and this was a year and a half after it all occurred. And I said, I'm a graduate student, and I'm just looking for any information to do with the meeting on March 11th, where it says there was a directive to remove Persepolis to all attendees of this meeting. And I'm just wondering if there are minutes or notes that were taken and whether I could see them. And so that's what I filed. I really didn't have high hopes. And then right before Christmas that year, I get this massive email from the Freedom of Information Act office. And I remember I was standing in my kitchen and my son was in his high chair, and it was just a very, domestic moment. And I'm like, and I look, and I'm scrolling through the documents, and everything, it's 46 pages of documents. So to begin with, they said, we have nothing.
Right.
I got 46 pages, but those 46 pages were completely redacted. Everything was blacked out. And I was like, why even send this? I don't get it. However, I noticed on my phone that every time I scrolled to a new page, the redactions would disappear for a split second. And so I thought, those aren't real redactions. Because real redactions would be, or redactions you can't, you know, hack.
Redact the redaction.
Exactly. What you're supposed to do is black it out with a marker, scan the item, and then that's it.
Yeah.
But I opened it up on my computer, and I noticed I could click every black bar and just delete it. And I had everything. And it went back to the weekend before the directive went out, an email that came from a network chief on the west side who had found a copy of Persepolis in a third grade classroom. Now, at the time, I had a third grader, and she kept asking, can I read Persepolis? And as a parent, I thought, no, I don't think you're going to read Persepolis. So should it be in a third grade classroom? I think that's for teachers to decide. I wouldn't put it in my third grade classroom. However, you know, a lot of schools get classroom libraries that are donated copies of books. Sometimes the teachers don't even know what's there before they, you know, check it out. And so this person said to this network chief office, I found this book, and here are a couple scans from some pages that I saw when I flipped through it. And she scanned in these two notorious pages where the depiction of a man being tortured by the Islamic Guard in Tehran, and then being murdered. For those of you who haven't read the book, their black and white drawings are very much in a cartoon style. But she just posted those, and it was an immediate decision from the head of the office. Yes, that book should be removed. Go ahead and do it. And then she literally said, and while we're at it, this book should be removed from every school in CPS. Mm-hmm. And that was it. My favorite part of so that answered that question, how did this begin? But my favorite part of what I discovered is that Barbara Bird Bennett, at that time the head of Chicago Public Schools, who has since been to jail for other issues, she said, I had no idea about any of this. And she's on every email from the beginning. It's her AOL address, but it's obvious it's her because it says
Barbara Bird Bennett.
Yeah. But
and so I was very proud to have at least helped out the Office for Intellectual Freedom in catching CPS in a lie, but I also in big lies, but I also think it was really instructive in terms of how library copies are protected and how.
Yeah.
And then also the power of local folks to call attention to and battle back attempts at banning. Yeah.
I think that's what's so interesting about a lot of this is how every person can have a role in protecting the books that are in schools and in libraries. And so, Deborah, I just wanted to ask you a quick question before we get to some questions from the audience. Given this unprecedented wave of censorship, tell us about the measure that ALA is taking to counter this and how people can get involved.
Well, in light of all that's happened, we frankly did some research because we were concerned. You know, had we lost the thread? But we did polling and we found out what we've always known is the vast majority of voters, of parents, people living in the United States oppose censorship as an education tool. And so as a result, we've developed a new initiative, which is intended to be a grassroots public-facing campaign for the public to use, called Unite Against Book Bans. And the intent is to provide you as individuals an opportunity to organize and make your voices heard at these board meetings and in elections where to oppose censorship. And we're really just launching this right now, but there's an opportunity now to go to uniteagainstbookbans.org. It's all one word, and you can sign up. And we'll be sending out information. There's a toolkit, actually, on the website now. And you can find those tools to fight censorship. Write letters to the editors, initiatives, how to talk to elected officials, how to activate your community. It's really important. All library politics are local. You have to understand that. You know, we can do just so much as a national organization. It really falls to you as individual voters, as individual residents in your community, as parents in your school board. Just go to board meetings. Know who you're voting for. you know, because these candidates aren't going to tell you that when they get on the board, they're going to start censoring all the gay books in the library, you know, but they're there and they're trying to do this. So know who you're voting for and participate in the conversations in your community. Unite Against Book Bans is intended to give you the tools and organization intended to do that. I believe there may be some bookmarks around the room somewhere. I'd be happy to pass them out. There's a QR code on the bookmark that you can use to go to the UniteAgainstBookBans.org. And you know, and what we really want to do is not only reach board members, but all the policymakers who are involved right now in these decisions to censor books on these faux ideas that somehow, elevating the voices of marginalized communities is somehow taking something away from other people. It's an absolute lie. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, given the current things, it's being accepted right now. So I encourage you to participate and reach out and get involved on the local level.
And from my own experience, I will say I have seen firsthand that this is absolutely how book bans are battled back, is the activation of the local community. Mr. Watson's Chickens was banned in a public library in Spanish Fort, Alabama in late February, or it was challenged for removal, and the person who filed the challenge said my book was a work of indoctrination, that because it's incidental queer representation, that is therefore normalizing queer folks and therefore trying to send the message to children that you should be liked. This person was not... This person had very, very religious overtones to her challenge. However, there was a mom in town whose son had come out when he was in high school. She contacted me personally asking me if I would write a statement to the board. I said, yes, of course, but more importantly, what she had done is she had gathered and invited 16 other people in town who opposed this action to write letters to the city council, who were also the library board, about why the book should remain on the shelves. And she was just tireless. She gathered all of these letters. She got stapled them into a packet. She delivered them by hand to the city council members. She spoke at the city council meeting. That packet included my letter. But I don't think my letter was ultimately what was most effective. It was her letter about her son, her ex-husband's letter about this, telling the story about the day their son came out to them. And miraculously, the city council voted unanimously to keep the book on the shelves. Mm. And she was shocked because she said, everything you've seen in the media or just representations of small town Alabama, that's who these city council members are, so I'm not hopeful. But she sent me an email that was just if you could do a backflip using email, like a subject line, she did it. And it was very, very exciting, but really it was because of the local folks who acted and really worked hard. So personally, I talk all the time to people I know. I live in Evanston, and people in Evanston like to get comfortable and say, this will never happen here. Mm-hmm. And instead of thinking that, think it will, it can and it will, and act now to gather folks who can either be activated when it happens so that you got your group or your email list and you're gonna go to the board meeting, or, like you said, act proactively in terms of why this should never happen in our town and why I oppose it, you know, in a letter to the editor, so on and so forth.
Right.
I really can't overstate how powerful and effective that is, that the local work is where it happens.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you to our program participants, and thank all of you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, award-winning poet Michael Warr reads and discusses his work, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.